This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. 150 years ago, the first woman cast a legal vote in the modern United States. It was here in Utah, in Salt Lake City. A young school teacher named Seraph Young voted in a kind of ordinary municipal election in City Hall. When it comes to women's suffrage, technically, Wyoming got there first. They gave women the vote in December of 1869, but the Utah Territory wasn't far behind, and that election Seraph Young voted in, that came first. But why don't more people know this? Why has that story, as some Utah women say, been buried? It's polygamy. The plural wives in early Mormonism were some of the most vocal and effective advocates of getting women the vote in this country. It's true. But the historian Catherine Kitterman says it's one of the details in the larger story of women's suffrage that, for obvious reasons, doesn't get told. She says at first, the political participation of these women was aimed at protecting their religious beliefs. The really crucial moment in this story came a month before Seraph Young voted, at this gathering on January 13th. It's come to be called the Great Indignation Meeting. Kitterman says Congress was considering a piece of legislation at the time that would disenfranchise polygamous men in the Utah Territory. It was called the Column Bill, and Utah women weren't having it.
A week before, there's a planning meeting in Sarah Kimball's 15th Ward Relief Society Hall. They come together there to protest this bill and say, what are we going to do about it? At that meeting, a motion is called and carried that says we need to demand the right to vote. They say we need a voice in the political process here in order to stop this anti-polygamy law from happening. And I think that's the real impetus for that larger meeting. It's a January night. 5,000 women crowd into the old tabernacle on Salt Lake City's Temple Square. And they keep men out, except for newspaper reporters. As they come here together, they have speaker after speaker rise to protest this Column Bill.
Make it plain.
And they talk about the ways that they have suffered persecution in the past, the ways that they have contributed and labored hard to build up this desert kingdom out here in Utah.
Is my right.
And in all of that, they say we're here to defend our men's rights. We don't want their voting rights to be taken away. If they do this to men, what will that mean for us? And as they talk about their religious liberty, the First Amendment principles that they think should protect their practice of polygamy, it's a sense of power, and it's a show of force. 5,000 women pack into this building in the largest women's meeting that's ever happened in Utah. There have never been this many women all together in one place. They invite reporters in. They print the resolutions that they pass and their speeches. They are planning to use this. Eliza R. Snow is the plural wife of Brigham Young. She had been the plural wife of Joseph Smith. She'd been involved in that early relief society in Nauvoo. She speaks here to say, we are not inferior to the ladies of the world, and we do not wish to appear so. It shows that women are powerful, that Mormon women can speak, that they are articulate and intelligent, and that they can marshal forces and organize to get involved in politics, to make a difference on both national and local levels. And that's a message that they're trying to send, I believe, to both national audiences as well as to lawmakers at home.
Kitterman says Utah women, American women, wanted something more than just a vote. They wanted back into the political process. She says women were part of that process in the early days of the country, but at some point, they were pushed out.
Historian Rosemary Zagari has written about this as a revolutionary backlash. But with the American Revolution and all of the opportunities and possibilities that that moment holds, there was a question of whether or not women could be enfranchised voters, could be part of the political system that's set up. And even though the Constitution and state laws in all states except New Jersey don't enfranchise women at first, there are still so many ways that women are involved. They're at political rallies. They're involved in this party politics. But as the early 19th century gets going, there's this partisanship and this divide and a sense that America is going to rip apart at the seams, that our politics are going to rip the country apart again. And there are lots and lots of examples of political methodology or political messaging that say women need to get out. This is too fractious. The debates
Women were making it worse somehow?
Not so much that women are making it worse, but that they need to remove themselves, keep to the domestic sphere, to keep that sphere unsullied from these partisan discussions and to be able to cool tempers at home and things and moderate that effect of politics, I guess, in a way. So the idea is your role is to raise citizens, educated citizens who are thinking and participating, but your role is to be at home, to continue the republic in that way rather than to participate. And you see so many messages coming from these political parties saying that women are irrational, unstable, emotional, all of these discourses that have been going on for centuries already and will continue, right? But that women are too emotional and unstable to be involved in politics, and that it will heighten the tempo and the flair of these discussions in a way that will be dangerous for the republic.
You write about how their contribution to society was, this is the word you put, recast. That their influence now, look, we'll handle the politics, you handle the home fires, right?
Right, exactly. It's called Republican motherhood.
You also say that when women did want to speak out publicly, because they never did entirely resist that impulse, of course, but they had to negotiate this tension and they had to figure out, how do I do this? How do I speak out, but do it in an acceptably female way? Talk about that.
Yes. So if women are supposed to be in a domestic sphere, caring for home and family and vulnerable people, then the ways that women get involved in the public sphere are through benevolent associations, charity work, work to help orphans or Native Americans or, in some cases, the poor. This idea that there are people who are vulnerable and that a motherly influence or a motherly instinct would naturally carry women to care about these issues and to do something about these issues.
One of the things you talk about is that this idea of, you mentioned, for children or Native Americans, so they could do it acceptably under certain parameters. Mm-hmm. But it was seen, this is how you've put it in your writing, it was seen more like prayer than politics.
Well, you see in these very early cases where women are petitioning, and this is with petitioning against Indian removal or for abolition, that women are phrasing their petitions in such a way that casts them as asking these benevolent men to do something for these weak women or for
petitioning.
Petitioning, yeah. And so women start collectively petitioning only, again, on behalf of others. They're not petitioning on behalf of women's rights at first or asking for the right to vote, but they are asking as women whose tender sympathies are aroused by this issue for elected officials to do something about the vulnerable people that women should naturally be advocates for.
But that didn't include themselves, because that would have been seen as unseemly?
Yeah, in the beginning, there's just no political space for that. There's no rhetoric to draw upon almost. Of course, there are women writing about this, Mary Wollstonecraft, others, but there's not a space in our politics that allows for that kind of advocacy in the beginning.
So let's shift to Latter-day Saint women in the 19th century. Are the causes that they're supporting, are the ideas that they're thinking about, I mean, they live in a very different popular culture, obviously. Mm-hmm. Polygamy is the big difference, I suppose. So what are the causes that they're supporting? Well, how are they different, or how are they alike, I guess, from other American women?
So in many ways, you could look to the founding of the Nauvoo Female Relief Society back in Nauvoo in 1842. As very similar to other benevolent associations, which are the first ways that women are organizing and speaking to each other and gaining those capacities and skills. But there's a different flavor to that, again, because there's this religious element in there that it's seen as a religious office as well.
So it's okay.
It is, right? And women are, again, coming together for, at first, it's Sarah Kimball's idea is we're going to sew clothing for workers on the Nauvoo Temple. Then they're going to take care of the poor and destitute in their neighborhoods. And so, again, what they are coming together to do as collectively as women is take care of vulnerable people and really extending that domestic sphere into the public sphere in a similar way to many other women's benevolent organizations.
So it seems like they're sort of dipping their toe into the political process. Tell me a little bit about what these Relief Society meetings were like in Nauvoo in those days, because I found this really interesting. You say that they were sort of conducted like with this parliamentary procedure. They passed resolutions. What was it like?
Yeah, so women are coming together to talk about membership, to vote in new members, to talk about their organizational work, the charity work, who has needs and things like this. But again, it's parliamentary procedure. There are men in the meetings, men speak at the meetings, but women hold offices, women run the show in many ways in the meetings. And again,
they have their own budgets. And
yes, and this sounds, it might sound limited, but women aren't speaking in public hardly anywhere. Abolitionists are having things thrown at them for doing this at the same time, right? So the fact that women are speaking publicly, even if it's just to other women, even if it's leading just other women, that's a first step in gaining some of these capacities.
So at first, their political participation is, you say, women, is aimed at protecting their religious community. Talk a little bit about that, because this is when they start getting engaged. And they're not really, as you say, thinking about the woman's vote. They're thinking about protecting their own kind of fragile faith at the time. Is that fair to say?
I think it is. You see this first collective political action happening on this wide scale here in Utah in the late 1860s when there's serious threat of anti-polygamy legislation in Congress. And that's really one of the impetuses that even brings the conversation about women's voting rights here to Utah. But it's also one of the things that gets Mormon women thinking about speaking out on a national stage to try to influence public affairs.
Tell us about the Cullum Bill. I mean, there were a number of these kinds of bits of legislation. They were anti-polygamy bits of legislation. But it seems like the Cullum Bill is one specific thing that we can talk about, because there is – it gets us to a – couple of great stories here.
Absolutely. So this isn't the first anti-polygamy bill, as you mentioned, but it passes the House of Representatives and therefore seems like a more serious threat. And it's a really drastic bill. It says that polygamists, therefore men right here who we're thinking about, will be stripped of voting rights, not be able to sit on juries or hold public office. So it really strips a lot of those citizenship rights out. And it seems like the most substantial threat yet to polygamy. And so Mormon women come together to decide what they should do about this. They're not indifferent spectators. Of course, this affects their families.
Sure.
And also they are irritated with the way that they're being represented on the national stage as well. They feel like they're being misrepresented when others talk about their plight as these oppressed and degraded women. And they want to correct some of those perceptions as well.
Say more about that. What are the perceptions? What's the if you are back east and you're trying to imagine what it's like for a polygamous wife in the Deseret Territory, what's this like stereotype?
It's the downtrodden woman. You see Mormon women compared to slaves in a lot of political cartoons in the 1870s and 1880s who are either dupes or being tricked or forced into polygamy, because the idea is that why would any woman thinkingly consent to this again? And so they
also, can I just mention, because you when you look at Mark Twain, for example, the way he wrote about Mormon women, polygamous wives, dour, frumpy, ugly,
dowdy, not refined, not educated, not pretty.
not pretty. And there's this moment you write about that Eliza Snow said this, which I thought was kind of poignant. She said, "We are not inferior to the ladies of the world, and we do not want to appear so."
There's a quest for respectability there, I think, that makes sense. But they want to speak for themselves and tell their story in the way that they want to tell it.
You mentioned how the indignation meeting in January of 1870. It was covered by the national press. And you include one excerpt from the New York Herald, which I loved, and I wanted to read part of this. It says, "It will not be denied that the Mormon women have both brains and tongues." in general knowledge, in logic, and in rhetoric, the so-called degraded ladies of Mormondom are quite equal to the women's rights women of the East. So Eliza Snow sort of got her way in that sense. Like, all of the sudden, people are saying, wait, maybe they're not these dupes that we thought they were.
And it makes a splash because, again, as you say, these women are speaking out in defense of polygamy. And that's puzzling to Americans. And so they have to take them seriously for the first time in some ways, maybe, because they're reading their words and their stories from their own lips.
Catherine Kitterman, she's a PhD candidate in history at American University and the historical director for Better Days 2020. It's a nonprofit dedicated to bringing attention to the history of Utah's suffragists. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Preach Podcast is back with a new season, and we're kicking things off with a very special guest.
Theology is this great aspect of the human enterprise, and you shouldn't have to go away to study it. Like, we should know more about it.
I talk with Krista Tippett, the host of On Being, about what she's learned from nearly two decades of deep conversations with everyone from Brené Brown to Ta-Nehisi Coates to the Indigo Girls. Find Preach wherever you get your podcasts or at preachpod.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of Seraph Young's vote. Seraph was a young school teacher, Brigham Young's grandniece, and on February 14, 1870, she voted in a Salt Lake City election and became the first woman in the country to do it. The role of Utah women in this history has been overlooked for some complicated reasons. Catherine Kitterman is an historian. Tell us who Seraph Young is. She's the first woman to vote in this country.
She's the first woman to cast a ballot under an equal suffrage law. And Seraph is a 23-year-old school teacher. She works at the University of Deseret in the model school. So she's teaching young students there. She's the oldest of nine children. She was born in winter quarters on the Mormon Trail on the way west.
Wow.
So she has a pretty typical Utah story in that way. She also happens to be the grandniece of Brigham Young. And Seraph is the first woman reported at the polls that day. My assumption is that she's on her way to work. It's a Monday. She's got to get there and get on with the rest of her day. So she walks to City Hall and makes her way through a brass band that's playing outside, stump speeches that are still happening. This is a contested election. It's the first election since political parties have formed in Utah. And she casts her ballot and makes history.
But did people, when she walks in and casts that ballot, was there like, this is the first woman, this is a big deal? Or it sounds like, because it sounds like she's like, I got to get to work. I'm going to cast, then I'm going to just vote, and then I'm like, almost no big deal. That's terrific.
It isn't a big deal.
Yeah.
The papers do mention she's the first woman who cast her ballot. That's reported here locally and nationally, but they don't make a big show. They don't report any other women's names who vote that day. And it almost seems like even though they know this is some kind of history, they don't quite realize how important this is. Again, Wyoming had passed a suffrage law a couple of months earlier, but women here in Utah went to the polls for the first time. And that moment, that story has been lost to history in many ways.
Yeah. The thing is, from this time onward, you say that LDS women's voting rights became entangled with this big controversy over polygamy.
Yes. And without the issue of polygamy, the discussion probably wouldn't have come up in Utah territory at that time anyway. Anti-polygamists in Congress have been looking for ways to end polygamy. Some suffragists back east, including Susan B. Anthony, have argued that if you want to end polygamy, you should try giving women the right to vote. Maybe they'll free themselves. And it's also a toehold. I think the suffragists are thinking this will be a way that perhaps women's rights can spread if it goes well here in Utah. And if not, as the New York Times says, only the Mormons will suffer. So try it out far away out west.
And it's a grand experiment that can play out in the west, and it shouldn't really hurt us necessarily if it doesn't go well.
Exactly.
Here in the east.
You can distance yourself from that. But so anti-polygamy laws had been suggested in Congress, introduced in Congress, that would enfranchise women. They didn't go anywhere, but the discussions start in Utah. The Deseret News, church-owned newspaper, comes out with editorials in favor of the idea. And
which means Mormon leaders were cool with it.
It sounds like it.
Yeah.
They say we can prove that women won't run wild or become unsexed. We'll show the nation even another example. We're already doing something novel here, and our women can be an example on another front as well.
By the way, why didn't women vote to end polygamy? I mean, Susan B. Anthony figured they would. Like, give them the vote and they'll say, we want out of this. But that is not what happened.
No. The territorial legislature passes this law unanimously, and the country kind of holds its breath and watches what women will do with the vote. Besides the fact that there's polygamy on issue here, these are the first substantial population of voting women in the U.S. They're an anomaly for so many reasons. But polygamy isn't on the ballot. Mormon women do not vote against male leaders that have been in power who are largely LDS at the time, right? And so they see that nothing is changing. The political structure isn't shifting. And as reformers see that nothing is changing, they start to get worried and they start to see Mormon women's votes as upholding polygamy, as again shoring up the political power of the LDS church in the territory and as something that will need to be gotten out of the way if polygamy is going to be eradicated.
So it seems to me, if I get the timeline right, they give them about 3 years to vote to end polygamy. When they see that's not happening, then, as you say, they start to decide we need to take away the vote of women in that territory.
Yeah, 1873 is the first year that there's a law introduced in Congress that would do that. The Liberal Party here in Utah, the opposition party to the church's People's Party, had been talking about this in the past. They actually will file several lawsuits here locally trying to invalidate the women's suffrage law in Utah as well. Again, arguing that women should not be voting or that Utah's legislature didn't actually have the authority to give women the right to vote, that they are voting wrong. They're voting against their interests. And that's really what, as these reformers see it, and that really is the main reason why they say they need to go.
So they make a few attempts to take away the vote. When do they finally do it? Because this does happen.
It does. 1887 is the year that Congress passes the Edmunds-Tucker Act. It's an anti-polygamy law that does many other things. But among those, it disenfranchises all Utah women. So polygamists
have been— Utah women.
Right. This is just a law at Utah, aimed at Utah. Because Utah's a territory, Congress can do this. And they invalidate the women's suffrage law. They state that no woman shall vote in Utah territory hereafter. They had previously disenfranchised polygamists. That was men and women. But it didn't go far enough. And so 5 years later in 1887, they say all women are out, regardless of marital status or religion.
So there were women who were voting in the West. The ones left out were the ones in the Deseret Territory, in the Utah Territory.
Yeah. At this time, women were voting in Wyoming Territory. Washington Territory had granted women's voting rights, and that had been overturned on a technicality. So it's really just a few small places where women are casting ballots.
Okay, so let's talk about when they get it back. So they don't have it. They get it. They take it away from them. And they get it back related to statehood. This is when Utah, through this long struggle, gives up polygamy, get statehood, and as a condition, women are allowed to vote. Now, that seems unique. How does it happen that that works out?
Yeah. So in 1896, when Utah becomes a state, there are only two other suffrage states in the nation. There's Wyoming, that has been voting since 1870, entered the Union in 1890, and then Colorado, that changed its constitution in 1893 to allow women to vote. So this is still fragile ground.
Yep.
There's still a question of whether or not Congress would accept a constitution that enfranchises women. But women have been voters in the past in Utah. They have 17 years of experience that they point to saying, we were independent. We were wrongly disenfranchised. The sky didn't fall in. You know, we went to the polls and we still took care of our children. The families didn't disintegrate, that sort of thing. And there's, again, widespread support in Utah for this idea. Among Latter-day Saint church leaders and the general population, it seems like most people don't think this will be an issue. So women worked from 1889 on under Susan B. Anthony's National Woman Suffrage Association. There are organizations in 21 counties across Utah, and thousands of women have been going to monthly meetings, educating each other on political issues, writing columns in their local newspaper, lobbying the lawmakers who were going to come together to write this constitution to say women are equal, we deserve the same rights that we've had in the past, and we want you to remember us when you're writing the organic law of the state.
So interesting that you have nationally women who are voting to become – sorry, you have women who are petitioning to become voting citizens, whereas the women in the Utah Territory are saying, we already had this thing and we want it back.
Right. And they had petitioned throughout the 1870s and 80s to Congress not to take away their voting rights. And they had said, we're citizens. We're exercising the rights of citizenship. Those should be protected. So again, I think they've learned some lessons from that. They want that enshrined in Utah's constitution, knowing even that that's not an absolute guarantee or protection, but realizing that they need something more stable.
There's a moment from the state constitutional convention that I want to mention because I think people may know who B.H. Roberts is. He's this beloved figure for Mormon liberals. He has this sort of liberal disposition, or anyway, seen that way. And he's kind of a backstabber in this story. He goes against women getting the vote in the, or at least being that, at least that being put into the state constitution.
And it's a surprise when he brings this up. There are 107 delegates in the constitutional convention. They have all pledged to support equal suffrage for women. Both political parties have platforms that support equal suffrage for women. And so the suffragists who have done their work and, you know, beaten the rounds and lobbied really feel like they have this in the bag. And then B.H. Roberts stands up in the Constitutional Convention and says, we should put this off. We should postpone the decision. Let's not endanger statehood. We've applied so many times before in the past. Let's just take care of this first and not give Congress a reason to keep us out.
And people are like, dude, what are you doing? Because they must have been surprised.
They were. And there are people who are not in favor of suffrage. Generally, they're non-Mormons who are concerned about the political power, again, that this
sure
will give as women are voting in Utah. So there are some people who like this that he's saying, but his constituents try to recall him. They say, this is not what we sent you here to do. Mormon church leaders, we can see in the records as they're meeting at this time, they're saying, what is he doing? He's stirring up this question again. This is going to be horrible for us. He's actually kind of slapped on the wrist publicly later on. So nobody seems to want him to do this, but he feels like he needs to make a stand. And then he goes a step further and says, it's not just that we should put this off until later, but aren't women already represented by their husbands anyway? Aren't they really not as good of voters as the rest of us? He gets into some icky territory that's really not the feeling of most Utahns, which is interesting. That's not the case. In the rest of the country, he'd be pretty normal for that.
Yeah, because that was the stereotype that he was mentioning, that women were weak-minded and they would just do what their husbands told them to do, and they were too emotional to vote, all those
things. Right, that's common knowledge in the rest of the country, but it's not here in Utah, interestingly.
But they do get it. It does become included in the state constitution. So talk a little bit about how unusual it was for a woman to be involved in a political campaign, because you write about the fall of 1896. Utah women are out campaigning. Some of them were campaigning for William Jennings Bryan, trying to get the vote, and they're canvassing, going door to door, I guess.
Yes. And interestingly, they've been doing that in the past. When the Constitutional Convention was debating suffrage, they were going around gathering petitions in favor of equal suffrage, saying don't postpone the question. And so as the door opens for them to run for office for the first time in 1896 and again to vote again, they use those organizational skills they've been honing for the last couple of decades to get involved about issues they care about. They split. There are Republican women. There are Democratic women. They're organizing ladies' clubs across the state on both sides of the issues. But they're really involved.
So is this about the time when Utah women really get fully engaged in the national suffrage movement?
They've been involved leading up to this. They've forged connections with Susan B. Anthony's organization, the National Woman Suffrage Association, back in the late 1870s and 80s, as they were trying to defend their own voting rights. They were looking for allies. The larger and more mainstream suffrage organization won't touch them. They don't want to work with polygamous women.
Yeah.
They're worried about what that will do to their cause. Susan B. Anthony was radical enough to work with anyone.
Yeah.
So they've had these connections. They've been speaking at meetings. They've been going back east and being put on the stage as voting women at these conventions and things. But once polygamy is less of an issue after it's been officially disavowed by the LDS Church, once they've gained their statehood here in Utah, women are really in a leading position to contribute to the national push for a suffrage amendment.
One thing we need to mention, and this is one of those kind of untidy parts of the story, and that is that women of color, people of color, are left out of this story. We're talking about this, you know, grand moment when they get to be able to exercise their franchise. Not everyone did.
No. And this hinges mostly on the language and discrimination in U.S. citizenship laws. So women citizens are given the right to vote in the Constitution. They were given the right to vote in the 1870 law as well. And that categorically excludes Native Americans, women from Asian countries who are not legally allowed to become citizens, who couldn't vote if they knocked on the door and banged it down. The situation is a little less cut and dry for Black women in Utah who are considered citizens by law. We see some interesting evidence of political participation in the 1890s. There are rallies of what's called at the time the Colored Women's Republican Club, talking about registering and voting, also mentioning that if registrars tell you that colored women can't vote, you need to push back. So we know that.
And say, I am a citizen.
Right.
I do have this right. And they did.
They did, it looks like. So we don't have voting records from the time. It's impossible to tell who actually cast ballots. But we see that while access to the ballot is likely uneven in ways there, that there are women who are pushing those boundaries. And it's an interesting part of the story. But nationally, the concerns of Black women and other women of color are not included in those national suffrage movements. In fact, when it comes time to choose, when push comes to shove, national suffrage leaders often choose to advance the cause of white women's voting rights at the express expense of the voting rights of men and women of color.
So that seems like another story that hasn't been told very well, that they're you need to track this down.
We're working on
it. Right? Black women who voted, like, and they were the first, would have been the first. That, I mean, that would have been amazing.
It really would. And it's a shame that we don't have those voting records here from Utah. But it's not to say that things are equal, that everyone is happy, everything is hunky-dory. But you see evidence of political participation and organizing. Women like Elizabeth Austin Taylor, Alice Nesbitt, they're women that we're digging into more to learn about their experience. They also would go on to form things. Elizabeth Taylor forms a Western Federation of Colored Women, as she calls it at the time in 1904, gathers women from across the West here, has the governor of Utah and the Salt Lake City mayor speak to them. Again, this doesn't mean that there's no color line or anything, but it shows a need to organize, and it shows the capacities and the vision that these women had that they were trying to play out. She talks about the double difficulties that women face as women of color. It's an intersectional speech there. Mm. She's talking about how Black women need to band together because we face these extra difficulties. But we don't see Elizabeth Taylor on the same stance as some of the white Mormon women who are leading those suffrage organizations, working with those national leaders. And there's a story to be told there.
Yeah. How important was it for these ladies to call themselves or think of themselves as citizens? Because you say laying claim to that identity was really crucial.
It was. Now in the 21st century, we think of citizenship and voting rights as synonymous in many ways. That wasn't the case in the 19th century. In fact, in the 1870s, the Supreme Court rules that citizenship does not necessarily guarantee voting rights. That's a huge blow to the suffrage movement, where women had been arguing that it did. But as Mormon women in Utah were trying to protect their voting rights, they had made these claims to citizenship. They said there are First Amendment protections and 14th Amendment protections that should apply to us in order to protect our voting rights as well as our practice of polygamy. They were able in many ways to make claim on that identity because they were voting, because they were exercising those rights that they argued were part of citizenship. And that was something unique compared to women in the rest of the country who were trying to prove their citizenship voting claims by going to vote and being arrested or fined for it. But as women pushed, this goes through the 19th Amendment and beyond, right, for an equal say, equal access to the ballot box, there's a sense of There's a sense of citizenship that comes out of this, that we are part of this republic. We are part and parcel of the decision-making structures. We have vested interests and we have a voice, or we deserve a voice, to protect and advance and defend those interests. And that's a discussion that really shifts across the whole United States over a long period of time, over decades. But Mormon women are working that out first in many ways as the first substantial population of female voters.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Catherine Kitterman. She's a PhD candidate in history at American University. She's also the historical director for Better Days 2020. It's a nonprofit dedicated to bringing attention to the history of Utah's suffragists. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
If you want public radio listeners to learn more about your business or organization, consider becoming a KUER sponsor. You can support informative, engaging programming through a variety of opportunities on our radio, digital, and events platforms. We're proud to partner with the community to bring trustworthy journalism to Utah. To learn more about becoming a sponsor, look for the support tab at KUER.org and click on Business Support.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When Nyland McBain first learned the story about Seraph Young's vote and the great indignation meeting, she was blown away by it. But she was also mystified about why more people didn't know the story, why it wasn't taught in history classes or celebrated by women's rights activists. So she and a friend, Mandy Grant, started a nonprofit called Better Days 2020. They wanted to explore what she says is this forgotten story.
As a transplant to Utah, I was shocked that I didn't know about this, but even more shocked that Utah natives didn't know this. This being that story of Utah women leading the nation in the suffrage movement and in the women's advocacy movement generally. And while Mandy and I were reading these biographies with these incredibly modern statements and these incredibly modern attitudes, we were reading articles in the mainstream media about Utah being the worst place for women, based on a series of metrics around equal pay, representation in politics, position on boards, etc. And so, of course, we asked ourselves, what happened? And pretty much every audience we've spoken to over the last 2 years has also asked that question. So we sought to...
You wanted to reconcile the two ideas. On one hand, there's this broad impression about oppressed women in the state, yet there's this deep history of powerful, incredible, badass women in the state.
Absolutely. And what's interesting is one of the reasons they were so powerful 150 years ago is because they were answering the same criticisms that we have lobbied against us today, which is that we are powerless and voiceless and oppressed. And so the women of 150 years ago rose up in inspiring ways to express their independent status and their agency. And we felt that that story was very inspiring, and also that the figures that came out of that time period are very inspiring. And I think that what it seemed is that this story existed in academic tomes and PhD theses, but because of the specter of polygamy, women had been defined by their marital status in a absolutely anti-feminist stance, and had been silenced because of their marital status. And as the church has wrestled with the legacy of plural marriage in the 20th century, they were no longer held up as these icons that they were. And so the story got lost. The story got buried. And we've all suffered from that, whether you're a member of the church or not, here in Utah.
Buried is a good metaphor, it seems like. What you had to do is, I think you've used the word, we had to excavate the story. We had to undig it, unbury it.
We did. And Catherine and her historical team and our historians really get the credit for doing that. And our education team, they went to primary sources on this story as well as on the stories of Utah women from the past 150 years generally, because we started with the suffrage story, but then, as I mentioned, it became very clear to us that church history or suffrage history is not Utah history. And so Catherine and her team have excavated Utah women's history from many communities, and we're very proud of that, that we have really tried to transform and broaden Utah history to represent lots of different communities.
We don't have to adjudicate this much, but I do think it's interesting to at least note the articles that you were reading that you couldn't reconcile with the other part. And this is still troubling stuff. You know, typical man earning a lot more than women when you were reading those articles still exists. Less than 31% of management positions held by women in Utah still, maybe not that quite figure, but it's still up there. Less than a quarter today of the legislature are women. So how do you respond to – because one of the things you're not doing is denying that these things don't happen. But I wanted to give you a chance to at least respond to there is something to parts of that impression.
Yes, we are absolutely not denying that those statistics are true. We have had people push back on those statistics that we've talked to over the years, saying, yes, but those statistics don't represent the quality of life here or the way that women here actually practice their feminist right to choose, you know, to choose motherhood, to choose different eras of their lives. And I certainly am sympathetic to that, absolutely. But I think one of the powers of this story is that the early leaders of Utah's government, which were in many cases the leaders of Utah's predominant church.
Yeah.
There was a vast overlap for the first 50 years of the state, recognized that these were political and social issues that should be part of the restoration of the gospel that they believe themselves to be a part of. Mm. And that tie is something that surprised us and that I think we're very quick to point out. The chief supporters of equal rights for women were the male leaders of the LDS Church. And so when you talk about things like equal pay, you have somebody like Joseph F. Smith saying specifically, I have a quote here from him that he spoke at a Relief Society conference in about 1895, 1896. And he said, if a man can perform labor for which woman is physically disqualified, let him enjoy it. But let the same be said of woman. By what process of reasoning can it be shown that a woman standing at the head of her family with all the responsibility resting upon her to provide for them should be deprived of the avenues or ways or means that a man in like circumstances may enjoy to provide them? And so he's talking very specifically here about equal pay. And he advocates for the opportunity for women to become the breadwinners and in their family, and to have equal opportunities, not just for employment, but for compensation for that employment. And so we would read statements like this and just be shocked at their progressivism and statements from the leaders who created our state constitution, who believed that equal suffrage would be the brightest and purest ray of Utah's glorious star, that it would beckon our sister states upward and onward to the higher plane of civilization. And so
B.H. Roberts notwithstanding.
Yeah, they were in the same quorum, and you would not see – we don't see that today with members of a similar religious denomination expressing discord publicly like that.
I want to talk about how polygamy complicates this story. And I wonder if in some ways, then as now, there's religious bigotry going on, that has come into play in this story.
Polygamy was the main motivating factor for the women's involvement in the suffrage movement early on here in Utah. You know, studying this story for me, one of the themes that I pull out of it as somebody who moved here from the East Coast is that it really explains the deep-seated origins of our state versus federal government antipathy, because that tension was existing from the very early days. Mm-hmm. And in many communities around the nation that were participating in suffrage discussions, there was an us versus them quality to it, but it was usually men versus women. It was usually perceived as a power grab by women, taking power away from the men, and a zero-sum game, right? If the women gain power, then the men lose power because there's only a limited amount of power. Here in Utah, the attitude was very different because they had a common foe. They had a common external enemy, which was the federal government and all of this anti-polygamy legislation. And so the men and women really banded together. And there was a beautiful element of sort of, you know, we as men gain power by empowering others. And that's a sentiment that I really think was a beautiful takeaway from this movement.
One of the things that you've talked about is how writers and observers, even now, then and now, they separated the West from the East in the way they conceived of the idea of suffrage, women's suffrage. The West, this is how you put it. You said the suffragists in the West were treated, their behavior was treated as aberrant political behavior, not part of a mainstream movement. So why? Why was the West singled out as different somehow?
Yeah, so by the time Sarah Young cast her first female vote in Utah in February of 1870, the suffrage movement had been around for two decades already. And they hadn't had any significant wins, apart from Wyoming's territorial legislature granting women the right to vote 3 months before Utah. And this state-by-state approach was really taxing. It was really resource-heavy. And so when these four states came into the Union before 1900 as suffrage states, so Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and Idaho came into the Utah as suffrage states, they were considered by the leaders to be great wins, and they were feted, and they were, you know, a lot of attention was paid to them. But unfortunately, as history has told the story, the motivations for those first four states to give women their civic rights today are either uncomfortable or unrelatable to us. Yeah. When we're even embarrassed by them a little bit. And of course, Utah, we've been talking about a primary example of that.
The polygamy. But there was also racism.
Wyoming, it was racism.
Yeah. But how do you disentangle those untidy parts from the larger story? Because it seems like that's what you have to do, is like, all right, let's put it in context. Yes, there was racism there. There's polygamy there. There was these other strange ideas here. But the West was there first. Mm-hmm. Are you struggling to disentangle those ideas?
Well, I mean, look, we're talking about history, which is never clean, never tidy.
Exactly.
We need to be suspect of it if it is. And we're also talking about two points, 1870, 1920, that are just two points along a continuum, right? I mean, the effort for women of color to vote in this country and to exercise their full political rights continued for decades, right? And we could say even 1965 with the Voting Rights Act was an ending point, but that's not true either. So you know, we're talking about limited groups of women, but at Better Days we talk about this a lot, and we feel like it's still worth celebrating. The action is still worth celebrating, and the reason it is because of the power it has on our ability to perceive ourselves. So if Joseph F. Smith also commented, I quoted him earlier, but he also commented that there are women who may be found to seem to glory in their enthralled condition, the condition of having no civic rights, and who caress and fondle the very chains and manacles which fetter and enslave them. Okay. And in my mind, today, casting off our shackles is casting off the external perceptions and expectations and stereotypes of what it means to be a Utah woman. And for me, that's the power of this story, is it gives us a platform on which to say, I don't have to be a woman who lives in the worst state for women. I don't have to be one of the worst women in the United States. I don't have to live up to that expectation of being one of the most oppressed, agentless women in the United States. It gives us a whole different path on which to carve our identities to say, you know, yes, it might have been history. It might have been messy. The history is messy. But these women existed, and there's lots and lots of elements of them that are relatable to us today. Lots of them. And so, you know, we want to take the power from those stories and cast off the shackles of perceptions and expectations today.
I want to come back to something you said early on. And this is something we were talking about earlier, that great indignation meeting where Eliza Snow says, we are not inferior to the ladies of the world. Do you think in some ways there's still that impression that you're still making that same kind of statement today?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think, you know, I would love personally for us to really stand up in defense of ourselves through our actions and not become as the rest of the world, but find our own unique, quirky Utah way of magnifying our women, because we always do things here a little bit differently in Utah, and I don't want to change that. I love that about Utah, but I think our women can rise up in unusual ways and be inspired by these stories and find their own different ways to magnify their potential. And I see that in the creativity that I see when I go to speak to university students or young women. They are just so creative and full of optimism and hope with how they can craft a very deliberate life. And I just sincerely hope that they don't feel shackled by those expectations of their national narrative about us, whether it be a narrative about Utah, whether it be a narrative about women in the church specifically, that we can do our own thing and have that unique, wonderful Utah quality really shine through in the way that we support our women because of the values of our community and not in spite of them.
Nylan McBain, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nylan McBain. She's CEO of Better Days 2020, which is bringing attention to the anniversary of the Utah women who on this day, 150 years ago, became the first women in the country to vote. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter, at Radio West. Our intern is Natu Tue. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard, by Ali Vallarta and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.